number 7-34C, United States of America.
I know.
The Sussman, for the appellant.
I know, that's what.
For the appellate.
Our calendar is bigger. Our calendar is bigger. The other one.
Morning, Mr. Sussman.
Morning, Your Honor. Good morning to everyone. My name is Ed Sussman. I represent the appellant, Travis Sweet. We're here on basically two arguments this morning. The first being that the trial judge committed clear error in the manner in which he sentenced Mr. Sweet by a total failure to consider the 3553A factors as required by Supreme Court and Booker and its progeny, particularly the Gall case. And as a remedy, we're requesting that there be a full remand and resentencing. As the second argument, we're also asking for remand based on the prima facie case of ineffectiveness of Sweet's counsel at the time of sentencing. The court will no doubt note that Mr. Sweet walked into the courtroom facing a sentencing range of approximately 87 months at the bottom, and was lucky to walk out of the courtroom without getting 188 months.
What did he get?
He got 151 months. So with regard to the first argument, I think that the Supreme Court made it clear in Gall that there is a particular methodology that has to be followed in terms of sentencing in the post-Booker era. That methodology is an accurate calculation of the guidelines and then an analysis of how the guideline computation fits with the statutory criteria. Any sentence that fails to take into account the statutory criteria, I think, by any standard, is unreasonable and requires that an appellant or defendant be resentenced. The record of this case is devoid of any meaningful or any consideration at all of the statutory factors. In fact, it's not hard to envision that this was exactly the kind of sentencing that would have taken place in the pre-Booker era. This was a case of nothing but mechanical guideline application, and we're not quarreling with the judge's computation of guidelines as such, but there was absolutely no analysis with regard to the 3553A factors. Mr. Sweet's initial guidelines were in the 87-month range, and by terms of the plea agreement, the government was binding itself to ask for a low-end sentence. As I've described, the sentence through the pursuit of the safety valve quickly ratcheted up, and only a save, if you will, by the probation office to preserve two levels for acceptance of responsibility. Had that not occurred, his sentencing range would have been 188 months to 235, I think, or something in that order.
Did they consider the gun? I can't remember.
I'm sorry?
Did they consider the gun?
He got the gun bump, yeah. That was not part of the initial pre-sentence calculation.
In the original calculation, yeah. The gun bump was not there.
That is correct.
The hearing made it plain that he had the gun, at least provided evidence that he had the gun with him and had it for the purpose of protecting the drug stash.
Right.
In
actuality, a gun had been found in the apartment at the time the warrant was executed. The probation officer could not assign the gun to any particular party in the apartment, and for that reason did not apply the gun bump or not suggest it. The government didn't press it. So in essence, Mr. Sweet had, use a bad phrase, dodged a bullet in the case of a two-level gun bump. The debriefing made it clear that Sweet had purchased guns previously and it had guns for protection of his drugs, which clearly made him eligible for the gun bump. Had sentencing proceeded as it might have otherwise, he would have probably escaped that enhancement. But with regard to the sentencing, the sentence had increased from geometrically. And I think it was incumbent upon the court to say, why is 151 months the least sentence necessary to achieve the statutory goals? why is it that the community needs to be protected by a 151-month sentence? Why is it that Mr. Sweet needs to be deterred by a 151-month sentence as opposed to the original 87-month sentence? Why does the 151-month sentence necessary, why is it necessary for rehabilitation of Mr. Sweet? Why is it necessary to promote respect for the law? We are not asking that there be some robotic, mechanical incantation on the part of the district court.
It is the case, is it not, that sentences within the guideline range are now held presumptively reasonable?
They are presumptively reasonable, but that presumption has, I believe, and would argue, no meaning when the court doesn't, when the sentencing judge doesn't perform his constitutional function of going back and running those guideline numbers through the statutory factors. In essence, if you presume the correctness of the guidelines without that analysis, you've just gone back to a mandatory guideline system. It's no different than pre-Booker. We're just arguing about the computation of the guidelines, and that's exactly what Booker and his progeny said is not supposed to be the case. Parenthetically, you could say that a sentence outside the guideline range after it's been parsed through the 3553A factors is not presumptively unreasonable itself. I mean, it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of the review, but in this case, absent the second element, the 3553A factors, you simply don't have a reasonable sentence that can be effectively reviewed, and the only remedy, I would suspect, is an urge to a remand for a full resentencing. This is not a Coles-type remand. Coles was a pre-Booker sentencing where it was unclear whether the sentence would have been any different, and the judge was asked if it would have, if the advisory nature of the guidelines would have made a difference. In this case, it is clear what the judge is supposed to do in some fashion. We're not suggesting exactly what the trial judge has to do.
Well, the government argues the judge's consideration of factors was implicit. So if you're not asking for, you know, a mechanical incantation,
That's correct.
What is it that you seek here?
Well, I think that the implicit, the government argues things, it's a scattergun approach. The trial judge or the district sentencing judge never said they were mandatory. Well, we don't expect him to say that it's mandatory. The kinds of things that were briefly discussed in the sentencing are no different than the kinds of things that would have been discussed in a pre-Booker sentence. We've always talked about these factors as to where they fit within the guideline range. Even under in the pre-Booker era, if it's an era, judges still had discretion within the sentencing range, and we still talked about age of defendant, things of that nature, to try and lessen, lower the sentence within the applicable range. I think that the 3553A factors requires a lot more consideration than those kinds of references, offhand references.
If the judge had, and this is probably too broad a hypothetical, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Sure.
If the judge had simply recited the 3553 factors and said, I've considered all of those and looked at the guidelines, and I think the bottom of the guidelines range meets all those needs, would that have been enough?
If my client had gotten 151 months, I probably would say no. If it was somebody else's client, I would have said that kind of that's not a meaningful review of the 3553A factors. Reading the statute is not a reasoned application of the statute.
Do you have to go through them each one by one and say why they?
Well, sometimes some of these things don't really apply as such, and I can conceive of situations where certain factors may not really come into play. But I can, in this case, clearly, and I'm speaking about this case, there's hardly a situation where some of these things don't come into play, especially in light of the extreme nature of the increase in the sentence from the way initially walked in. In essence, Mr. Sweet got 5, 6, 7 years because he testified falsely testified at all regarding the
And that's your other issue that
right.
We've talked you away from, that but for his his decision, which you say was the counsel's insufficiency, he would not have provided the court with the information that resulted in his sentence being in a higher range than would otherwise have been.
Simply put, risk-taking is a function of criminal representation in all cases. We all know that, and there are calculated risks. In this case, the defendant was, as they say, drawing dead by virtue of what he had said at the debriefing. The gun wasn't automatically.
What?
Pardon?
I didn't understand your phrase.
Oh, it's a card term. I mean, he had no chance right from the start to get the safety valve because his clear admission of weapons possession was an automatic disqualifier. The rest of it was a credibility determination, and it was probably fairly thin to expect the trial court to believe that all of these things were true. Some of it, the court might recall, related to his lack of knowledge of activities of people who were arrested alongside him in a small apartment who had pled guilty.
Count of how he got the drugs that involved him giving money to a cokehead without even knowing how to get a hold of him again.
Well, it's a strange world out there, but it's not one that's that strange that the trial judge is going to believe it, given expert testimony from experienced detectives concerning what their take on the matter was. There may well be some logic to the decision, and that's why I think remand is the appropriate measure here. Maybe counsel can explain exactly what the thought process was. Maybe it was the insistence of the defendant. That's not my understanding, but those are the things that I think have to be explored given what transpired at the sentencing hearing.
So that's the necessity for the hearing, namely to understand what counsel knew and determined, and I realize these two issues are somewhat interrelated in the sense that counsel asked the district court to sentence at the low end of the guidelines, never asked for any recitation of factors, never asked, you know, just to view the guidelines as advisory and go even further below.
That would be part of it, but I would point out, Your Honor, that I think in the Bras case, the circuit held that that unreasonable sentencing need not be protested. You don't have to preserve the record on that, and that our argument is that a sentence that fails to take into account the statutory factors is per se unreasonable and requires remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is used up. You'll get back a couple of minutes if you need it.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Jay Apperson for the United States. If I may, as a preliminary matter, Your Honor, with the Court's permission, we cited on page 26 of our brief case of United States versus Kirkland, a 2000 decision by this Court, but it was an unpublished opinion. That citation, unfortunately, runs afoul of this Court's rule of citing on...
You're apologizing for something you don't need to apologize for. We do accept citations.
I believe, it was, as I read the rule, Your Honor, it was after any case after 2002, we may cite.
Before 2002?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, I see it is.
And so I apologize to the Court for our error there. We do, however, rely.
I haven't looked at it. I don't know about my colleagues.
Well, our opposing counsel was also kind in not zinging us for that, but I apologize. We do rely on Brewer v. Aikens, the Seventh Circuit case, which is cited in Kirkland. For the proposition that we argue in our brief, and the position is correct, but we are precluded from relying on Kirkland as authority. So I appreciate the Court's indulgence in letting me clarify that. Your Honor, appellant is entitled at most to plain error review. There is no basis for either a remand and certainly no basis for a reversal in this case. Appellant got the sentence that appellant asked for, but more importantly, the sentence that was compelled by the plea agreement. Counsel was precluded from arguing for a sentence below the bottom of the guideline range. Paragraph 9 of the plea agreement makes it very clear. The client agrees not to seek any decrease from the client's base offense level other than for acceptance of responsibility. And further, counsel agrees not to seek a downward departure for any reason from the otherwise applicable guideline range established by the sentencing guidelines. So the suggestion in appellant's reply brief that counsel was deficient for not asking for a lower sentence can hardly be correct because counsel was obligated under the terms of the plea agreement. not only...
Even though the circumstances had changed dramatically?
Yes, Your Honor, because other parts of the plea agreement clearly indicate that the appellant acknowledged it is for the court to make the determination with respect to all of the sentencing factors. And that was clear from the entire...
Government,
I'm sorry.
I just need to be clear about this. If the circumstances change, nevertheless, counsel is precluded, as distinct from the government saying that's not the agreement, and therefore, you know, this plea agreement is no longer on the table.
It is, I respectfully suggest it is, Your Honor, and that's why the plea agreement was worded in such manner as it was.
So the agreement says no matter what happens, counsel is hereby forever precluded?
Well, it's the applicable guideline range is found by the court or the base offense level, and the plea agreement deals with both situations.
I understand that, but where it changes, you know, the plea agreement is talking about A to D, and now we're talking about A to Z.
Well, there's no question that the parties contemplated a particular calculation, but as appellant acknowledged in the plea agreement and elsewhere, he acknowledges it's for the court to determine. It's not, even though the parties may understand that this is where we're going to be, it may be a completely different matter when the court does its job and makes an independent determination as it's required to do under the statute. So appellant acknowledged that, counsel was aware of that, and so counsel was precluded. Counsel, of course, asked for the bottom of the range, got better than asked for the low end of the range, got the very bottom of the range, the 151 months.
But is it your position that even in light of our opinion in Saro, that it would be inappropriate to remand for a hearing on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
I do, Your Honor, because for no other reason than appellant cannot show Strickland prejudice for receiving a sentence that included a gun bump that was lawfully required to be imposed. There's no suggestion by appellant currently on appeal that was an inappropriate gun bump based on the facts of this case, or the obstruction of justice as we set forth in our brief in Fretwell, in Nix v. Whiteside, and also the Seventh Circuit case of Brewer v. Akins, which I just referenced a moment ago, I think stands for the clear proposition that there is simply not Strickland prejudice here.
But would you agree that if, this is a hypothetical, if the district court were to find there had been ineffective assistance of counsel, then there would be Strickland prejudice? I mean, there are two sides of that same coin.
Well, of course, the court must find both deficiency in performance and prejudice.
Right.
And, of course, the court need not, neither this court nor the trial court need to get to the deficiency if there is no prejudice.
But my point is, I understand your point about, you know, he suffered as a result of his own testimony. That's not prejudice. But if indeed it was ineffective assistance of counsel, hypothetically, ever to ask for this hearing without having done some homework, then he never would have testified.
Well, I believe the court's question goes to the deficiency prong of Strickland. And I'm simply suggesting the first instance, because there's no prejudice, neither the district court nor you need to get to it.
But my questions go to, there's no prejudice if counsel was deficient, because then he never would have testified. And that's what the problem here is.
Well, if I may address the deficiency issue, the suggestion is because counsel clearly knew that the appellant was precluded to get the safety valve as a matter of law because there was a gun looming there, therefore she should not have called.
No, had a plea agreement.
Well, you had a plea agreement that did not set forth a gun bump.
Right.
Neither the government had suggested that there be a gun bump, nor the probation office in the pre-sentence report had suggested there be a gun bump. So I think it's unreasonable to assign to counsel that clearly counsel should have understood that there was a gun bump coming because it escaped everybody else into the hearing.
Go ahead.
It wasn't just the gun bump. Yeah. She was asking for a safety valve. And on the road to a safety valve, the gun is not just a bump, it's a major pothole. You can't get there.
Your Honor,
the gun is in the case. So we're talking about the risk involved in risk assumption in criminal defense. She was assuming the risk of something going wrong, for example, endangering his credit for acceptance of responsibility, when she should have known that she couldn't get the safety valve anyway, wouldn't she?
Your Honor, it's important to know the context in which the safety valve came about. This was not an original motion by the appellant to get the safety valve. The probation office had assigned the two-point reduction for the safety valve, put it in the original calculation of the guideline range, and suggested it was for the court to determine whether or not it was being truthful. And even in assessing that safety valve, the probation office not only did not assess a gun bump, but did not preclude the safety valve for the very reason that the court is suggesting, nor did the government. The only basis upon which the government opposed the safety valve was that the appellant was not truthful to us.
The better argument is it not the windfall argument that the Strickland progeny say that the loss of a windfall is not a sufficient establishment of prejudice? Right?
Absolutely. That's what Fretwell, Nix v. Whiteside, and the Seventh Circuit decision in Brewer that we cite stands for. The appellant was simply not entitled to be sentenced on to receive a guideline range that did not include the gun bump and that did not include the obstruction of justice for his false testimony before the court. That was lawfully required for the calculation.
I mean, the district court here itself asked counsel, does your client understand the risk? So that the district court clearly was alert to the risk that's about potentially to happen here. And my question is, wouldn't a hearing clear up what counsel knew, what she had discussed with her client in terms of his testimony, all these types of things? I thought that's the nature of the district court's inquiry to counsel. You're about to throw away what looks like a great plea agreement for your client.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, because that consideration is irrelevant, and I point to the Brewer case.
Which consideration?
The consideration of deficiency is irrelevant when there is no prejudice as
I know. I hear this loud and clear, and I understand that. But I'm just saying the prejudice that bumped up the sentence never would have happened had counsel arguably properly evaluated the situation her client faced, given her knowledge of the potential evidence that the government had and what her client was going to testify to before the district court, she having already been present at the debriefing with the two detectives. So she knew that if her client got on the stand and said anything to the contrary, that the government had the option of calling those two detectives to undermine her client's credibility, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, actually, the detective did testify and was very unclear as to what it was the appellant who testified. That was my gun, clearly, in the thing. I think it's
if we hadn't had the hearing, we may say that there are cases that say loss of a windfall is not prejudice, but before this testimony was put on, the client was better off than he was after the hearing.
Well, Your Honor,
at the bottom of a lower guideline range, if he hadn't done it.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, the court looks at the totality of the representation. Now, if all that is attributed.
Right now, with respect, counsel, I'm asking you a question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And the question was, without regard to those windfall cases, there's no question that what he would have been sentenced at the bottom of a lower guideline range if he hadn't had this testimonial.
I don't know that that's true, Your Honor, and if I may explain, there was also evidence as revealed in the testimony, but was also before the court elsewhere in the pre-sentence report of additional drug dealing, another offense for which was dismissed as part of this. There were three guns involved. The court may well have, based on the information before it, given at the high end of the range or a departure for another gun. Frankly, if everything attributed to counsel was true going into this, she got a remarkable plea agreement because it may well have kept him.
The problem seems to be that she blew part of the consequence of that plea agreement by having this hearing that seems to have resulted in the greater sentencing rate. Now, you can say there are other factors that might have resulted in it with that, but that didn't happen. There's nothing to indicate that in the record. You're speculating when you do that. The record that seems to be that there was a lower guideline range before that day than there was at the end of that day. Is that not correct?
Well, but that is correct, Your Honor. That is absolutely correct, but there is no prejudice. I thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sussman, you are out of time. We'll give you back 2 minutes if you need.
Get news one. With respect to the first prong, the argument about I think the plea agreement with regard to counsel's requesting a sentence at the low end really doesn't matter. The court is still, sentencing judge is still required to utilize the 3553A factors. It's tantamount to what the government is saying is that everybody can agree the guidelines are mandatory and they should be applied in the pre-Booker manner, and I don't think that is the law. With respect to the second prong, I think Your Honor understands this is clearly a lawyer do no harm. The court had not indicated any intention whatsoever to depart upward, which is the standard.
In fact, warned counsel that she was risking bad consequences.
And the answer was somewhat equivocal. I think he does, which is hardly very assuring. It could be guideline levels. It could be years. Who knows what the appellant really knew about what risks he was taking and the likelihood that he was going to get anything out of this. He did get something out of it, but and that's exactly why we think it should be remanded back.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Mr. Sussman, you were appointed by the court to represent the defendant appellant in this case. The court thanks you for your service to the defendant and to the United States. Call the next case is submitted. Call the next case.